Okay, good evening, Erev Tov. We're leaving Eliyahu behind and beginning a long association, a reasonably long association, with the Talmud, with the student, Elisha. Before we begin, I'd be remiss in not mentioning... Good evening. Stay for the share. I'd be remiss in not mentioning that the Torah world was suffered a tremendous loss, a number of losses. A number of Rosh Yeshiva passed away recently, but the gentleman who really made a big impression on everybody who met him was Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, who was born and bred in Chicago. If you've been reading any of the obituaries about him, he... I read somebody's comment today, which I thought was very telling, and so how Art Scroll are going to present him, because he went to regular high school, he went to Ida Crown, or what it was before he became Ida Crown. The Rosh Yeshiva was very much part of that scene, part of that world, went to Eretz Yisrael in 1963 and never came back, and became who he became, and the head of the Meir Yeshiva, and married Reb Beinish Finkel's daughter, who... I knew Reb Beinish. I actually knew him in the 80s when I was living in Israel. Reb Nosson Zvi I never met, but my son met him and told me what a remarkable man he was.
I had the privilege of attending some of the shiur, and my son took me there to his house.
Remarkable. I mean, firstly, the man had Parkinson's, and he
like you've never seen before.
It was just so unbelievable, and it's on. If you want to see, it's on YouTube. You can see sort of some of the lecture. He was here about a year ago, and he spoke in Lakewood. Somebody from Fairlawn was driving him around. It was literally as close as that. His taxi driver is from Fairlawn. And he really was a very special man, Nosson Zvi, and really a very great loss. The yeshiva is now in a very serious situation, as we've been told. It's an important institution. It's a very important institution. What is the future of the Meir Yeshiva? I don't know, but the history of the Meir Yeshiva is certainly something, again, very remarkable, which I don't want to go into now. But I think it certainly behoves us to note the event and to maybe dedicate our learning in memory of his neshama, may his neshama have an aliyah. Also, I forgot to mention last week, is the memorial of Kristallnacht, which I do mention every year, the 9th of November 1938. I always talk about my neighbor in London. I mentioned him again, Felix Wolkenfeld, Zichron Livracha, who became a chover, for those who, a number of people here will know what that means, at the age of 16. And that is unheard of. And the reason is because on Kristallnacht, he saved two Sifrei Torah, pulled them out of a burning shul, and was honored by his community at that time. Very short-lived in Germany, he came to England. And for years he was called up a chover. Nobody really knew what the story was till he passed away. And then all of a sudden everybody found out what exactly had happened. A remarkable man. And when it comes to that, to those events, when you personalize it, it does become a bit more, I wouldn't say meaningful is the wrong word, but it's certainly you feel more connected to those events, those terrible events in those days. So again, that's something that we've just commemorated. I want to look at, well, look, we're on page 150. And we're just beginning the parsha of Elisha. We've actually seen Elisha before. We saw him at the beginning of Perek Bet. We saw how he was not going to let go of Eliyahu. Eliyahu wants to leave, wants to take his leave, literally. And Elisha says, no, you know, stay here. So Eliyahu tries to go to different places, and eventually he goes up in this whirlwind to heaven, as the story goes. And we spoke a lot about that last week, what exactly it means. We spoke about the Malbim and various other commentaries that are on record at the moment. It's amusing because I'm speaking at YU on Sunday in the Kolo Yom Rishon to the women. I'm talking about Leo. So if you want to hear it all over again, it'll be on that particular shiur as well. I'm trying to bring all of that, those like 10 hours of shiurim into 1 hour, but it's pretty difficult. Anyway, we'll see. The Psukim that we're going to start from is really the end of Perek Bet, verse 19. Remember, Elisha asked Eliyahu before he left him, that he said to him, I want to have a special bracha of double your koach, double your strength. And Eliyahu said to him, well, if you see me disappear the way that it's going to happen, because he knew something was going to happen like that, then he says, that's a siman, that's a sign from heaven that you're going to have this particular bracha. Does that mean Elisha was as doubly as strong as Eliyahu? That's something that, you know, you maybe have to make up your mind. We certainly don't relate to Elisha the way that we relate to Eliyahu. Eliyahu Hanavi is who he is. I'm not going to say was, because we have this tradition of his being sort of with us and being around for the rest of time. That doesn't apply to Elisha, but there are some incredible stories. And as I said last week, one of the signs of the doubling up is that twice the number of Nisim happened to Elisha, if you count them out, than happened to Eliyahu, as recorded in the stories of Eliyahu. It was 8 miracles for Eliyahu and 16 miracles for Elisha. And we're already beginning that in Pasuk Yud Tet. This is where I want to start today. Chapter 2, verse 19. And it goes like this. Eliyahu is gone. And Vayomer Yud Tet, the people say, Anshei Ho'il El Elisha, the people of the city. And seemingly this is where he was, which is back in Yericho. The people of Yericho say to Elisha, Hinei no Moshav Ha'ir Tov, this is a great place to live, Kasher Deni Ro'eh, as you can see. All right, I've been to Yericho. I was there before it was given back to the Palestinian Authority. It was a very hot place, if I remember rightly. One of the hottest I've been to, but the fruits look really good there. So he says, this is a good, they said to him, it's a good place. Trouble is, the water's gone bad. All right, and there is this kind of pool of water in the middle of Yericho, which you can see to this very day. And Meshakelet, people are dying. People are drinking the water and dying. So Elisha, help us. So he told them, take some sort of new jug of water or something, whatever it is, not water, but an empty vessel, and put salt, which is not really going to help the water at all, unless you're looking for a nace. And they took it to him, so he went to the source of the water, and he threw the salt into that spot. He said in the name of Hashem that I have healed these waters. Lo yeh misham od mavet mishakolet. No more death is coming out of the waters. And what happened? Vayeh rofu amai. And the waters were healed. They became literally, rofu can also mean softer, but I don't think he put water softener there, but whatever it was, they became drinkable. Ada yom hazeh. And it stayed till this very day, and I think even beyond the day. Remember, who is writing the Sefer? Traditionally, it's Yirmiyah. Jeremiah. So he's talking about right at the end of the first temple period, the waters in Jericho were still drinkable. Kidavar Elisha Shedibah, as the word of Elisha as he had spoken. So this is miracle number one. Okay, and the rabbis are at pains to make the comparison with Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu did the same thing. Remember with the waters, and the whole story there. And so there's interesting comparisons to be made. But we'll go on. And again, it was just to make the miracle sort of into a serious miracle, a serious nace. Bris Melach, and you can read into it a whole symbolism if necessary. I mean, that's, you know, I'll leave you to do that. The story continues, and this is a very difficult story, and the rabbis are perplexed because Elisha, his reputation will be very much less fiery. All right, he doesn't live with fire, and he doesn't live with the way that Eliyahu conducted himself, Ish Min HaShamayim, and all that sort of stuff. But there is a very serious story here in terms of kavod of the respect towards Elisha. And look what happened. Chaf Gimel. V'yal Misham Bet El. They go from there to Bet El, and Bet El was the place where, you remember, Jeroboam set up all of the one of his avodah zaras. He had two agalim. He had two idols which he set up, one in Bethel, in the middle of the country, and one in Dan, which is right in the north of the country. And this was a place, Bethel had a kind of reputation, even though Eliyahu tried to go from there to Shemayim, but the reality was Bethel did not have a good reputation in terms of who was living there. And they go there. Vahua lebaderech, and Elisha was walking on the way. Unarim katanim. Now you can say these were little children, but it's more likely that they were sort of like teenagers, youngsters. And what did they do? Vayitkalsu bo. Vayitkalsu means to mock him. All right? The kales is a word that we normally use for praising somebody. But vayit kalsu is here. It's got the kind of this expression we use in the Gemara, loshon sagino. It means the opposite. Not praising him, they were mocking him. Vayomerlon, they said to him the following, alei kerech, alei kerech. Without anyone feeling too bad about the fact that they may not have much hair, Elisha was one of the earliest cases of it. He was bald and he was told, alei, go up. Now, what does go up mean? And it could very well be that Mepharshim again explained, alei here means that maybe they were saying to him, your master went up to Shemayim, you should follow him. They didn't like him. These youngsters were making fun of him, they were mocking him. All right, and Elisha was not too excited about this. And what did he do? It's a strange story. So he turned around, he saw them. And he cursed them in the name of God. All right, now what happens next is not necessarily what Elisha says should happen, but this is what happened. There was some sort of forest. Some of the Chazal point out in Gemara, Midrash, that it wasn't there until that moment. It was like what they call there's a story called the Magic Forest, and one wonders if this is the origin of it. And what happened? Two bears came out of the forest, and 42 of these young people were literally devoured by the bears. Very strange story. And the Mepharshim are very perplexed. What's going on here? This is like so severe. You know, I mean, almost to the point where this is what we expect Eliyahu to do, except he does it with fire, he doesn't do it with bears. So the rabbis are very perplexed, and if you just follow with me, if you have the Radak, then you probably don't. Let me just see if it's in the Matsudas, because I think you do have the Matsudas there. Just one second, let's just see. Yeah, Chafdala, this is one of the answers of what happened over here. How could, if you're with me, Matsudas Dovid, all right, which is on your page, I think at the bottom of the page there. And if you've got it, I'll just read through very briefly. He gives one of the answers. Why could Elisha do this? So it says, Vayire, right? He saw them. So says the Masudas, Omer Rabbeinu. What does it mean, he saw them? You know, they were there. What do you mean, you saw them? They were screaming at him. So he says, no. It means, Shera Baruch HaKodesh. He used his divine spirit. He saw in the future. She'ein Bahem Lachluchis Tova. There was nothing good going to come out of them, and that's why he cursed them. You know what this reminds me of? The only way I can explain it, Ben Saramara. It has to be Ben Saramara. He treated them as Bnei Saramara, the whole lot of them, and they all got the same punishment, ala makom, straight away. It wasn't Aviv Ve'ima, it wasn't classic Ben Saramara, but you can argue that the Rebbe is like the Abba, like the father. You know, he decides for the child. He's involved with the process of Ben Saramara, and whichever way you understand it, that was the consequence. Very shocking.
Same thing.
Sorry?
Moshe Rabbeinu did the same when he killed the Mitzri.
Where they killed the Mitzri, correct.
The Jew.
Yeah, and killed the Jew. But this is 42. This is very shocking. This is right. much bigger number. And Chol V'Chol, what exactly that means?
Into the future.
There's that the Radak brings a whole bunch of other reasons, which the Matsudas doesn't bring. And he says, for instance, I'll just read it here. It's a very small print. A whole bunch of things. He says that, for instance, they deserve to be punished because they made fun of him. All right, they mocked him. So, you know, you don't mock the Talmud Chacham. It says that the Pirkei Avot, you know, be careful from the stare of the scholar. All right, the person who is the Talmud Chacham, don't bring his negative stare or his negative reaction towards you, because it says that is a surefire way of having trouble come your way. All right, without going into detail, another suggestion is that the rabbis say blurit ra'alahem ka'ovdei galilim. He saw that they had a hairstyle like non-Jews, like idol worshippers. And therefore he treated them as Ovdei Avodah Zarah. This was in Bethel. And the idol was in Bethel, one of the Agalim, one of the idols of Yeravam, still there. And therefore they had a din, a halacha of Ovdei Avodah Zarah. And of course in that case, again, it may be that's why they were punished straight away. He also brings this lachluchit mitzvah idea, which the Matsudas brings, the idea that he looked into the future and he saw that no... It's an interesting word. It means literally moisture. No freshness. There's no sense of growth in these young men, and therefore they were punished for this negative behavior. But interestingly, what the Masudas doesn't bring and the Radak does It says that later on, Elisha was punished for this. He didn't get away scot-free. He should not have behaved b'midat hadin. He was doing essentially what his Rebbe used to do, midat hadin. Now Eliyahu lived, remember we spoke about this, Eliyahu lived on the cusp, he was on the edge. And everything Eliyahu did was black and white, midat hadin. With Elisha, maybe it wasn't the way to go. Maybe there were other ways of dealing with this. You know, I mean, you don't just sort of snap your fingers and 42 children just expire on the spot or get taken away by bears. I mean, it's a very shocking story. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. He's looked in the future and he saw that they're going to be cursed or they're going to be turned out to be lousy kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he cursed them.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they turned out as badly as they did.
Exactly. And it's so severe. It's you know what it says to me. It's a leftover from Eliyahu, and it's not his style. You know, this again is reminding me of is the comment that the Gemara makes about Moshe and Yoshua, right? Moshe is the sun, Yoshua is the moon. He's a reflection of the Rebbe, but he's not the Rebbe. And again, Elisha is a reflection, but he's not the Rebbe. And when he employs the Rebbe's methods, it's not acceptable. Because the rabbis say, and I'll just read it to you again, the Radak says it very clearly. He says he was punished later on. He caused death to these children. He was punished. And he was punished in three ways. He had three afflictions later on. And there's a whole story. Gehazi, we'll come to all of that in due course. And essentially, you know, this is not a good story. This is not a good story. This is not a magic moment of Elisha's career. It really is a very difficult event. I can only do as best as I can on this because, you know, you can see that this is not typical. And later on, you already get the sense that Elisha is much more, going to use the word chevraman. He's not the Eliyahu, very aloof and sort of, you know, flying around and doing all the things that he does. He's much more in touch. Elisha becomes a not just a national prophet, he becomes an international prophet. He's actually going to be in touch with events outside Israel. He's going to influence other kingdoms. We know the story of Naaman. Naaman was this famous general from the Aram, the Aramean army, and he comes to Elisha. He comes from Syria or even beyond, who knows, and he comes to get cured. Now, how does he know to come to Israel? And there's a story there. There's a girl who tells him, a Jewish girl who tells him that there's a prophet in Israel. Go and see him. He'll cure you. And, you know, Elisha's got a reputation. He's already, you know, what the Germans call Wunderrabbiner, you know, the wonder rabbi. But in the positive sense, he's the guy, the go-to guy when you're in this kind of desperate situation. But again, what we will do, I'm not going to do it today, is we'll talk a bit more about this idea of nace. Because we don't build our religion on miracles. We're not that religion. That's the other lot. That's the other sort of like 50 billion people in the world. We don't build our religion on the basis of miracles. We have Nisim as part of our tradition, but we don't live comfortably with Nisim. All right, we have the idea that the Rebbe can whatever pray on your behalf, but you know any Rebbe who really is serious and does this for you will say at the end of the day, you know, that all he can do is make a tefillah on your behalf, and it's between you and God. All right, he can just be an advocate on your behalf, but there's no concept of really sort of the Rebbe changing nature, changing the world. It's a very uncomfortable concept that we don't live with, but clearly it is a tradition which we find already in Tanakh. So we'll as I said, we'll come back to this in due course. We've got I'll save it for after Perek Dalet when we have the miracle of miracles as far as it goes here, the Tchias HaMeisim. But look at Perek Gimel.
Very interesting, by the way, in the Mishnah in Perkei Avos, if you take a look at the fifth parak,
yeah.
It talks about different types of death that come to the world.
Yeah.
Dever, famine, it also talks about cherev, and it also talks about chaya ra bal the ola.
Yeah.
Two things, chaya ra bal the ola. Ashur shav,
yeah.
Achil Hashem.
And Achil Hashem.
This could have been Achil Hashem.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's why it came with the highest rose. Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of be interesting to see if any Mephoroshim pick up on that from this story. I really don't know. But it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, it also says that you have to be careful with cover of Talmidim. And cover
of Talmidim, right. Yeah. Yeah, Gachleyesh.
And
they got burned. And that so the whole Mishnah really can revolve around this particular story.
It's
the interesting
Hashem,
thing.
Hashem,
Yeah, it is interesting. It's kind of scary as well, whatever Chayes Ros means in the current world that we live in. But that's another discussion. Perek Gimel, I really don't want to go into it. It's a kind of frightening thing. The Perek Gimel is a story. We're going to run through this story. I'm really saving some comments really for the end, because the end of the story is really the bit, the way the story turns out is what's going to tax us. So hold on to your hats, as they say. We'll just go through this very, very briefly, and you'll hear a story which maybe never heard before. Gimel, chapter 3. Perek Posel Kafei of chapter 2, Vayelech Misham Ahar Kamel, Misham Shav Shomron, and Elisha basically goes back, he goes home to Shomron. Fine. At this point in time, that's where he is. He has no, well, we commented already for a number of weeks that they don't go south. They're not necessarily doing anything in the south of the country. They're staying in the north. Even though the north is clearly much more affected by idolatry and by all the sort of negative vibes, these guys are staying there. Clearly, they feel that's the place where they have to be to try and have a positive influence. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so why did he go?
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. Yeah. You know something. Yeah, but why Har HaKarmel? So think about what happened in Har HaKarmel. This is paying homage to his Rebbe. I mean,
it's the Nais. The world.
Yeah, it's the Nais. It's where the whole event of the fire came down from heaven.
Maybe he feels some dejection from the job.
And possibly goes for some chizuk there.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. I never thought of it. I'm pleased you pointed it out, because it's interesting. Why would he have to go? And it's a bit of a detour.
You think, like, recharges batteries?
Recharges batteries, literally. Yeah, but you got to be careful when you say that with these guys. Yeah. Well, it's near. It's near. That's a different part of Carmel. All right. We'll go on. Gimel, listen to this. And here comes the story. Now, Yoram ben Achav. At this point, Achav is dead. So you've got, remember we had Ahaziah, and Ahaziah died. He fell through the roof and eventually died. Tried to get Eliyahu to give him a blessing, and it didn't work out. And now we've got the second son, Yoram. Malach al Yisrael b'Shomron. He's the king of Israel in the northern kingdom in Shomron. Bishnat Shmona Israeli Shafat Melech Yudah, and he became the king when Yehoshaphat in the south, who is the great, or whatever, number of great grandsons of David, he is the king of Judah. So 18 years after Yehoshaphat started, Yoram became the king in the north. Vayimloch Shtem Esrei Shanah, he was a king for 12 years. Fine. So we've got all the dates established. Now, Vayasa Rabbeinei Hashem, Yoram unfortunately could not put things right. He did evil in the eyes of God. Rak lo kaviv kimo, but he certainly was not like Achav, and he wasn't like Izeva. And Izeva's still alive. We haven't done with her yet. We're still going to have, she's going to reappear, and her daughter reappears, which is even worse, as you'll see in due course. But the father is gone. V'yasarad matzvata baal asher asar aviv, and he certainly got rid of the Baal worship. That was pushed out, but it wasn't a clean out. There was still Avodah Zorah all over the country, all over the north, and it stayed. But listen to this. Rak b'chatot Yeravam ben Nevat Hashem Yisrael davek. He still cleaved to the sins of Yeravam, basically getting people to serve idols. Lo sami man, and he stayed. He stuck to it. He didn't move away from it. It could be that he was afraid of his mother, because what his mother would say. She was a bit of a difficult person at the best of times. There's this wonderful midrash which says that as much as she died, her hands and her feet were buried in a kvura, in a proper grave. And the question is why, and I mentioned this once before, because she used to dance at weddings. Jezebel, unbelievable. And number one, who would invite her to the wedding? I always wondered about that. But assuming that you would invite her, she danced at the wedding. She was leading the dancing. You know, sort of the, whatever it was going on the women's side. And that was Izeva. It's unbelievable. So because her hands were clapping and her feet were dancing, they received burial. The rest of her body, no. It was left for the dogs, but her hands and feet got buried. The rabbis say incredible things sometimes. Listen to this, Dalit. We're gonna talk about a character that we may have heard of. Umesha Melech Moab. There was a king of Moab called Mesha. Hayan Noked. And what was he? He was a sheepman. He was a shepherd, right? He had sheep. Veishiv Melech Yisrael, Me'a Elef Karim, Me'a Elef Elim Tzame. And basically the tax that he had to pay to Israel every year was this enormous number of animals, sheep and Elim and rams. And, you know, 100,000 is a lot. Vayihi kamot Achav. And of course, we read that already at the beginning of chapter 1. Achav died. Vayifshar melech Moab, but melech Yisrael and Moab, the king of Moab, rebelled. And he starts a rebellion. Obviously, the tax burden was very severe. And, you know, the Moabites, the Jordanians, we live in a very uneasy relationship at the best of times today, and nothing has changed. So, Vayetzeh melech Yoram b'yomahu mishomron. Yoram's got to do something about it. He's got a rebellion. The Moabites are rebelling. And this, as I said, is nowadays it'll be coming from Jordan. So he leaves Shomron, the king of the north, Yoram. But you've got at Kol Yisrael, and he basically counts Israel. In other words, he makes an army. He gets an army together in order to fight. But this is where it gets very interesting. And this is, again, always, to me, it's the lament. It's Yirmiyahu's lament when he's writing this. That when he reads the history, as much as they were two separate countries, the north and the south of Israel, they do come together at a time of crisis. And this has been true in Jewish history forever. All right, you know, we could be who knows what sort of arguments we have. Till it's a crisis, we're all in the same boat. Wham, everybody all of a sudden turns up in shul. Everybody comes together. And nothing has changed about that. And look what happens, Zion. Vayel, what does Yoram do? Vayishlach al Yoshaphat, Melech Yehuda. He sends a message to the king of the south, Yoshaphat, Lemor, to say, Melech Moab Pasha, I've got a problem. The king of Moab is making rebellion. Hatelech iti al Moab lemilchama. Are you going to join me in an army to fight Moab? Vayom ele. He says, I will go up. In other words, you know, no problem. Kamoni kamochon. This is so sad. We're the same. We're all Jews. Ka'ami kamecha, like you, like me, like your people, my people, your people. Ksusayk sechem, my horses, your horses. In other words, our armies we're on the same. We're basically the same enemy of Moab, be it the north or the south. And you know, I'm prepared to help you and do whatever I can. Unbelievable. And they would come together like this. And of course, you would say, well, why don't they just unite and make the country come together? We already saw. We saw there was a reduck about this. It just was not. It was meant to happen already many years earlier after Shlomo's death, and it never happened. It seems to be that was the sort of plan until the Churban, the way it was going to work out. It's a thought. Chet. Vayom ezer derech na'ale. So of course they have a discussion. Yoshaphat says, "How shall I come up to the north to meet you?" Vayom derech midbar Edom. Go through the desert of Edom. Now, Edom today is the equivalent of Saudi Arabia. So what happened was, seemingly, that Edom was also under the control of Israel, right? Which is interesting, because in those days they had all the oil, didn't need it. Nowadays it's this sort of different situation. But the reality was they appointed, the Mephoshim say, that the governor, the king of Edom that we're going to talk about, may be an Edomite, but he was appointed also from the Jews. Tet by Yelech Melech Yisrael, Melech Yehuda, Melech Edom. Three kings: King of Israel, the King of Judah, North, South, and Edom, who was further south. They all went together. Vayasobu derech Shivat Yamim, and they went round about for 7 days. They basically got their armies together and they started marching for 7 days towards the enemy. But their supplies were not there. The army marches on its stomach, as you know. I was in the Israeli army, I'll never forget this. We ate five times a day. Not exaggerating. You finished davening at 6, you had your inspection by 7, you're ready in the Shechem. Shechem is the army canteen. Right? And you were eating again at 9, you were eating again at 11. You had lunch, and it was like an unbelievable, it was like a sort of constant, not a lot of food, but obviously they realize, you know, because you're doing so much running around, you've got to have the energy to do it. The army runs on its stomach, every army really does, and if you can't get the water right in Israel, you're in real trouble. And of course, this is what happened. Look at the story. Yud. Vayom HaMelech Yisrael, so the king of Israel said, So the king of Israel said, we're in trouble. And you can see that the sense of awareness of what Hashem has in plan. All right, you know, again, he couldn't bring himself to get rid of the idolatry, but he seems to be more connected to God than the previous generation in his language, in the way that he spoke. Acha, remember, we spoke about all of the ways that he rejected Hashem. He knew about the God of Israel, but he pushed him out as much as he could until almost to the end. But that's a whole story in the past. But look at what happened here. Yoram, the king of the north, sees this as God's plan to really punish the whole of Israel, to put them into the hands of Moab. Yudal. Vayomer Yoshafat. So Yoshafat says, wait a minute, don't give up so quickly. Ha'ein po Navi Lashem v'nidrashat Hashem me'oto. There has to be a Navi, we'll have to ask him. Vayanecha me'avdei melech Yisrael vayomer po Elisha ben Shafat. There is a Navi here, Elisha ben Shafat. She'atzak ma'im alidei Eliyo, who poured the water on Elijah's hands. There's a whole chazal that Eliyo actually, his fingers became like fountains of water. Whatever that means, I can't even explain it. But this was Elisha. In other words, symbolically, he drew the water from Eliyo. He is the inheritor of Eliyo. Vayomer Yoshafat, Yeshoto Devar Hashem. And Yoshafat said, the word of the Lord must be with him. Vayeredu Elav Melech Yisrael, Yoshafat uMelech Edom. They all went to see him. And I don't want to go into, there is even nuances here. It's called Melech Yisrael, Yoshafat. All right, not called Melech Yoshafat, just called Yoshafat. And then Melech Edom, Melech again. So again, there's different nuances here. There seems to be that the relationship here, particularly between the king of Israel and Yoshafat, is very close. All right, so even to the point where, although he's Melech Yisrael, Yoshafat doesn't have to be called Melech. They're going as Chaverim. But look what happened next, you Gimel. Vayomer Elisha, Melech Yisrael. So Elisha says to the king of Israel, Mali Valach, what are you doing here? Lecha Navi Avicha, in other words, go to your father's prophets. All right, go to the Baal, go and ask those guys, like we had before with the Baal Zavuv. You remember? Vel Navi Emecha, to your mother's prophets. Right, he puts in a real shtech. Vayomer lo Melech Yisrael, Al no ki kara Hashem nishlota malachim ha'ele lateta tam biad Moav. We can't do that. It's too dangerous. We're in the verge. We're on the verge of losing to the king of Moab. Please help us. Vayomer Elisha, so Elisha says, Chai Hashem tzvaot asher amadati lefanav, by the life of Hashem, makes an oath, ki lulei pnei Yoshafat melech Yudah, ani noseh. He says that if I wasn't respecting Yoshafat, imabite lecha v'imerecha, I would not look at you. In other words, basically, Yoshafat saves the day in terms of Elisha's relationship to Yoram. All right, and Elisha's being very tough on Yoram, and I think for obvious reasons. But he says, because you've got Yoshafat here, and he's the Eniku of David HaMelech, I'm going to talk. V'atah, he says, now, Tedvan, I'm going through the story quickly, but I've got a point to deal with at the end. V'atah, k'chuli menagen. Very interesting. Elisha says, if I'm going to do prophecy, I need someone to play me music. All right, and again, music is considered to be very, very, not just soothing, but very inspiring. All right, it's nothing like a piece of Beethoven to really get you going if you're into that sort of stuff. There is a comment, I think, in the Chovos Halvavos, the Ibn Pakuda, very famous sefer of the Spanish school of rabbis, talks about the koach of music, and that it's very close. It's like the next one down from the spirituality of learning of Torah is the spirituality. I don't remember the language he uses of nigun of music. Which is fascinating. So at this point, he needs music to become inspired, and he says, when I hear the music, the hand of God will be on me. In other words, I'll be able to tell you what to do. And at that point, he gives a prophecy in the name of God. He says that Hashem has said the valley will become full of water. Remember, they need water. So you're traveling through a low lying area. You'll see that there'll be pools of water coming up from the ground. This is a big nace. All right? Doesn't happen in Israel very often, unless, of course, when it rains in the winter. This is not, presumably, winter time. Ki kom Hashem, next posse, Yudzayin. God has said, lo tiru rach, lo tiru geshem, anachala hu yimolimai. There won't be any rain, there won't be any wind, but the river will come up from below, fill the, there must have been like holes in the ground, wadis and whatever, full, and they fill with water. Ushtitem atem, umiknechem, behemtechem, everyone will have enough to drink, you and your animals. Menachal zo b'nei Hashem, this will be easy in the eyes of God, v'natanet moab b'yedechem, and you'll win. And this is the promise. And this is how the battle plays out. Now look at this. Very interesting. As a result, you'll be able to destroy the enemy cities, all the choice cities. Again, the rabbis have a big problem with this. They're being told to destroy the trees. Now we know that there's halacha in the Torah already, which talks about not cutting down, particularly fruit trees. You're not supposed to do it. There are many shilas about shuls that were built on land where there were trees. Could you cut down the tree? Could you say that in order to build a shul, you can actually destroy the trees? And at this point in time, This is an absolute command from as part of the deal here, that they've got to destroy the trees. Rashi says here, if you just look at Rashi, Chol Eitz Tov Tapilu, Afa Pi Shenema. Rashi asks the question, Lo Tashchit Et Eitza, don't destroy the trees, says in the Torah. Kan Hitir Lechem, a special allowance over here. Shehi Uma Bezuya V'Niklet Lefanav. Because the trees belong to Moab, or represent Moab in this sense, they became despised. I suppose you can say, you can always use, almost use the word tome or treif or whatever word you want to use, the trees became infected. So at this point in time, this wasn't cutting down healthy trees. They may have been physically healthy, but because they belonged to Moab, there was a special allowance. That's Rush's answer to the question. As I said, there are other answers, but I really don't want to go into that now, but that's a whole sugya. It's a halachic discussion about the way that we deal with trees under many circumstances. So it's something to be aware of. But at this point in time, they're being told, get rid of the trees. V'chol, back to the pasuk, chol mine mayim tistomu, you've got to close up all of their sources of water of these towns, these enemy cities. V'chol achelka tova tachiv b'avanim, and you've got to fill all the fields with stones. Basically, once you win, you've got to make them absolutely subservient to you. They will not be able to attack you again. V'yihi b'boker, and here comes this credible victory. He says, in the morning, kalot amincha, at the time when they would bring at the mincha, the early offering, water came up from the south, and it filled the earth, and the water was being reflected, the sun reflected on the water. Now here comes an incredible part of the story. Firstly, the Moabites heard that there was a coalition against them, and they felt pretty confident. And they got everybody together, all the people had swords on their belts, and they were standing by the border, they were ready for a fight. And at this point, the sun started reflecting on the water. It's an unbelievable story. And they had a kind of reflection, which the Moabites could see. The water looked like blood. It reflected red. I suppose it was a very dramatic sunrise, you know, so in Israel you can have that. And look what they said. Vayomer. So they thought, that coalition, what a waste of time. Dam zeh charev nechrev amalachim. The kings have all been fighting each other. There are three armies there. Of course they're not going to get on with each other, because they're all at loggerheads. Vayaku ishadrei. So they thought that what they saw was not water, but it was blood. And everyone had been killed. The Atal Shlal Moab, and now Moab can go into the camp of Israel and take the pickings. Of course, what they decided to do was walk straight into the enemy camp without even holding up their weapons or whatever. And as a result of that, they got a most tremendous shmeis. They were really beaten. Chafdalet. Vayavol Machne Yisrael. They came to the camp of Israel. Vayakuma Yisrael. Of course, Israel saw them walking in as if it was like the middle of the day. They're walking sort of, you know, along the broadwalk in Miami, wherever, and nothing's happening. And, you know, the Shpatziran, and of course, they were giving themselves over to the enemy, in their enemy, in this case, to Am Yisrael. Vayaku et Moab. He says they hit Moab. They smote them. Vayanusim ibnem. They had to run away. Vayavu bo. Was it Vayaku? I can't see what he says here. Yeah, Vayaku. Vayaku bo vakot et Moab. In other words, double, triple, over and over again. This was a complete routing of Moab. At this point, they followed the conditions, they filled up, they destroyed the cities, they filled up all the earth with stones, got rid of the trees, and got rid of the water supply. And basically they went around with the climb, with the shooting, the guy who shoot the catapults. That's what it's called in English, the guys who sort of, you know, like you see in the movies, they had these catapults and they shot stones, and basically they destroyed the cities. Here comes the most incredible twist in the story, and it blows the mind. Vayar melech Moab, this guy Mesha, he's in big trouble. What do I do? Ki chazak mimeno milchama. He realized he's losing the battle. They thought they were so confident, and they made a terrible mistake, and they're losing. And at this point, what did he try to do? He tried to get out. You know, he's not an honorable king. He wants to save his skin. So he took 700 men carrying swords. They seemingly were nearer to the element of the army controlled by Melech Edom, and they tried to get to him to at least, you know, fight their way out. Veloyacholu, they were not able to do this. Now here comes this incredible story, and I just don't know what to say. At this point, what happened was, and there's a machlok in the Meforshim, what exactly he did. Mesha took hold of either his own son, who was going to take over after him, or some say it was the son of the king of Edom. He managed to capture the son. And v'yaleu ola ala choma, and he brought him as a sacrifice, child sacrifice, on the wall of the capital of the city of Moab. V'yiketzef gadol Yisrael, and it worked and became very big tina, very big anger against Israel. V'yisume alav yeshuv la'aretz, and Israel had to run away. They went back to Eretz Israel. What is going on here? How do we? You see this story. In other words, it's victory is 100% guaranteed, and then at the end, a little twist. And what does he do? He does child sacrifice, the most abominable thing. You know, the Torah is so against this, and he wins. Mesha saves the day. What is going on here? Let me give you this, and you'll see that the rabbis are really it's beyond description what exactly is happening here. Just one each, yeah. I was looking around today. I found two sources. One that we've used before. Both of them, in fact, we've used before. One is from Rav Ariel, Yigal Ariel, who is a teacher in Israel, in the north of Israel, who's written this wonderful series of commentary on Tanakh. And at the bottom on the left-hand side is from a Rabbi Ginsberg, who was a Rav in Denver, who brought out a commentary on Tanakh in 1945. I'm assuming he's not alive anymore. Whether there's still family in Denver, I don't know. But his sefer, Musar HaNaviim.
There are Jews in Denver?
There are, in 1945. But guys who could write perish on Tanakh. It's a fabulous commentary. I mean, he was a Litvish, and one assumes he came from Lithuania. Because, you know, he seems to have the whole thing. I mean, today Denver's a very strong community. In those days, I don't know. It's so interesting. But look at this. On the right-hand side, we'll look from the middle of the page. Totsaot ha-ma'aseh. Yicholot litparesh. Right? He basically asks the question, what's going on here? How could Mesha's offering of the son, be it his own son or be it the son of the other king, how could that have any effect on the war? On the contrary, it should have been more reason for Mesha to lose than to win. And he says, I'm going to explain it, but often tzva'i, it's either had a military effect, but often psychologi, a psychological effect, or ba'ofin dati, a religious effect. Listen to this. Allah. Efshar la'avin et hashpa'ato shel ha'maaseh ha'nora hazeh. This is a terrible thing that Mesha did. What effect did it have? Ba'ofin metziyuti pashtani. I can look at it in a very simple, kind of practical way. Ma'aseh shel Mesha, shiritzad milkom, ba'ofin kol kach nora. He did this human sacrifice to Milcom, another name for Molech. Molech is what we call it in the Torah. But it was called Milcom, the same thing. It was so terrible, Hishpia amukot ala Moavim hanoashim, that it had an immediate effect on the Moabites who were almost at the point of Yish, they were giving up. Shehayua saf shvira, they almost were broken in pieces. V'choshvu, they thought sheshikutsam panalehem arim, that their God had rejected them. And this was their God. But now Mesha brought them back. Be'ikvod milkom hit odudu. Because of this, they became encouraged. Hechaziku ma'amad, they became strong again. Bolmu et nufata krav, they absorbed the attack. V'yisrael neltsu leherech limetzor mimushach. And then Israel had to go into some sort of extended attack, you know, sort of siege. Matzor kaze mitafyem b'machalot magefot, and then all of a sudden you get disease, and they have to leave eventually because they can't keep up the siege because the army gets sick. Shebehed etnaim heginiim, there's no hygiene. Svirim tokfot et anzurim. The Hebrew is very difficult, but he basically says that what happens is those who are fighting are all of a sudden at a disadvantage. The Jewish army was at a disadvantage. Ve'etzava hatzar alayir ke'echad. Ketzev hu negev. And he says, when it says there was ketzev, it means plague. Literally, the Jewish army tried to continue the siege, and they were beset by plague and disease, and they had to leave. That's one explanation to explain what happened here, that it's not anything more than a kind of military response to what happened, the way that Mesha conducted himself. The second explanation is more challenging. Bet. Haben lo haya beno shel melech Moav. As I said, some of Farshim say it wasn't his own son, Mesha, who he killed. Ela beno shel melech Edom. It was the son of the king of Edom, who was the part of the coalition of Israel. Mitoch yiyush, hista'er melech Moav amachaneh Yisrael. That at this point, out of giving up hope, the king of Moab, as it were, did something towards the camp of Israel. V'kivein l'nekudato chalashan. He looked for the weakest point. Edom, the third wheel, the third part of the wheel, which was the Edomite group. Aval lo itzliach litfos et ha-melech. He couldn't capture the king, Melech Edom. Ela et beno. He captured the son. B'yusho, and as a result of giving up hope, He'elad ben ha-melech ha-shavui, he brought this son, he showed on the walls of the ramparts, he killed the child of the king of Edom, le-korban al-achoma, on the wall, v'etzliach ligrom bekach le-pirud, la-shamot ha-dodiyot, and the army started breaking up. The third element of the coalition between Israel in the north, and Israel and Yehuda in the south, and Edom, the Edomites, pulled out. They said, this is too terrible to bear, we can't stand it. B'toch machaneh Yisrael. So psychologically, he says, that's the effect that this offering had. The third item is really mind-blowing. And I've just got to read this to you. I can't say any more. He says, Chachamim lo nisu lefashet et inyan. V'heim evinu et akrava k'maseh puchanid. In fact, the rabbis seem to see this not as a military or psychological thing. They see it as a religious act. It was almost as if he was offering something to idolatry or to heaven. What does that mean? There was an inner influence that he wanted to achieve in a spiritual way. Mesha, the enemy king. This is such a terrible thing. No way could that have benefited the Moabites. It was a terrible thing he did. Aval itzliach lekatreg al Yisrael. You know what happened? He brought a terrible, terrible kitrug on the Jewish people, a terrible complaint. The complaint was very simple. What was he reminding everybody of by doing this? The Akedah. He was reminding he was reminding God of the Akedah, the God of Israel, and saying that I am prepared to do an Akedah, but I'm not just prepared to do it the way Avraham Avinu did, I'm prepared to go through with it and kill this child. Let's assume it's his own child. And I'm prepared to do this, and your people, Israel, who have this in your history, and you have it in your tradition, and you know what they're doing at the moment? They're worshipping other gods. How can you remotely help a nation that supposedly is with you, God of Israel, and your people are away from you? And this was Mesha's plan. It was a religious attack on the Jewish people. Unbelievable. Totally amazing. If you go to the next column, and I'll just read it through again very quickly. Perush, it's six lines down in the bracket. Mesha kineset kol astrologim. He got all his astrologers together. V'alahem, he said, lo amartim shani osem milchama. In Kolomot and Osei, so he complained. He said, "You told me I was going to win. So what do you mean? The Eloi Yudim notzchimoti, but the Jews are winning. How can it be?" Amrulo. So they said to him, "Bizachud zakeinecha." We're reading about him at the moment. There's this old man, Shayalahem. They had him once upon a time, and he saves their life every time. Zachus avos. So Amalehem. So Mesha said, "Mihu? Who is it?" Amrulo Avram. He said, "Abraham." So Amalehem, so he said to them, he said to the astrologers, Masa, what did he do? Amrulo, so they said, Nolad lo ben echad, Keshahaya ben Meir, a son when he was 100 years old, Vigriva, and he offered him up. They didn't bother to mention the fact that he didn't go through with it, but that's what they told him. Amalehem, so Mesha said, Vigriva, oh, he asked him the question, he said, Vigriva, did he do it? Amrulo, lo. And they said no, so they were honest. Amar, so he said, in below Shekriva, of course, this is his mind. Even without finishing the job, but Paul, Nasalo, Nissim, miracles happened to Abraham. Even if he didn't go through with it, Elohi Kriva, Lacha, Kam, Vakam, if he did go through with it, how much more so? In other words, what Mesha thought is that if he goes through with his sacrifice, the God of Israel will be so angry for the fact that Am Yisrael has a history within their history of what Abraham did, even though it wasn't a complete act of sacrifice on his son, and they are not in any way now, observing that history, respecting the history, because they're going after the Baal, and they're going after the Asherah, and they're going after all these gods, and I, Mesha, will show that how wrong the Jews really are. And he went through with it by killing his own son. Unreal. And look at this last comment here from Rav Ariel. Nechonatam shel umot ha'olam lemesirat nefesh chashva nekudat utzma pnimit shel emet betocham. This is almost a sign of emes within the non-Jewish world. They're prepared to do this. V'garma lekesef al Yisrael shelo nintza bahem deveikut kazot. The Jews could not bring such closeness to God the way that the non-Jews did it. I always argue that, and this I think is true really in our history, that sometimes the certainly in Israel, the Arabs are frummer about a lot of our traditions than we are ourselves. The Shah Rachamim is bricked. You can't go through it into the old city of Jerusalem. Right? Because that's the tradition that Mashiach is going to ride through on a donkey or BMW, whatever it's going to be, and he'll come into the old city. Right? So what have they done there? They put a cemetery outside the Shah Rachamim. So just in case we can't stop him with a brick wall, he won't be able to go through because they believe that, you know, it's a cemetery, it's a holy man, he won't be able to go in a cemetery. Not understanding, of course, if he's not a Kohen, you know, Eliyahu will have a problem maybe, or Pinchas or whatever, but Mashiach probably not. But whatever, you know, they're very firm about a lot of these traditions which we... How should we say? I don't know. We kind of sort of put them into our folklore. But for the other nations of the world, no, they seem to take it very, very seriously. And that is what's happening here with Mesha. He is doing something here, and I can't explain this, but it works. It works for him in such a way. It's such an awful story and such a terrible conclusion, and yet they can't beat him. They have to run away. Am Yisrael is defeated in this. Am Yisrael retreats. And Mesha, at least in his capital city, he lives to be there for another day. Rav Ginsburg has got a very similar concept. He compares it to Shaul HaMelech, who did not want to be abused by his captors, so he committed suicide. We learned that story a long time ago. And he says Mesha was prepared to do the same. He didn't want to be abused by his captors and by the enemy, so he was prepared at this point to show that, you know, he's going to sacrifice his child. Eventually, the suggestion is he was going to kill himself rather than be taken by the enemy. So therefore, again, another sense of a merit for him is that he was prepared to do this, a kind of mesirat nefesh, you want to call it that, and as a consequence, that was the way that he got out of a sticky, as you say in English, sticky wicket, sticky corner. I don't know what to say. I leave you to ponder on this story. It is really a very disturbing story. Elisha is obviously featured very highly in the whole story, that I have to say. But again, what we do see from this story is that there's already not just a national, there's kind of an international reputation that the prophet is beginning to maintain. And this will become something very significant later on with Naaman, as I said, and further on with other stories. Elisha takes the whole prophecy, the concept of the Navi, into a much bigger arena. And that's what makes him so really, really interesting. Very, very fascinating gentleman. Alright, we'll leave it at that. Thank you for listening. Mirtz Hashem, next week, the famous that we had in Haftarah. So those who are awake for the Haftarah last Shabbos will already be ahead of the game. Yeah? Yeah, yeah.
And they're sinning too.
And they're sinning by watching it. Yeah, yeah, similar to the story with
Pa'o.
Yeah, with the women, yeah. But yeah, it is very disturbing. Yeah, it's very distressing that he could pull a shtick like this and get away with it. All right, number one, that he's prepared to do this, which is very disturbing, but that the fact that he succeeds. But that's, something to think about, our relationship to God. It's a sort of, you know, like this. It's never on the even keel. All right. Thank you for listening, everybody. Mitzvah Shem will continue next week. Thank you.